climate change and the American Southwest.
A drought is going to be the big factor in the decades ahead, and I'm deeply worried about it. I've spent my adult life out here in the Southwest, and I feel as though I've been involved in a long love affair with the land. And one of the things that scares me the most is the prospect that some of the forests that mean a great deal to me, if they were to burn, it would be heartbreaking.
That's William DeBuise. He tells us about the future of his beloved land under climate change. His book is A Great Aridness. And are we confronting the end of growth?
I'm not trying to convince people to stop chasing growth. I'm trying to convince them to be comfortable with the end of growth, because it's here whether we like it or not, and it'll be a lot more graceful for us to stop fighting it.
That's filmmaker Dave Gardner. We talked to him about his movie Growthbusters in the second half of the show. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The American Southwest is one of the most beautiful places in this country. From the world wonder of the Grand Canyon to the cloud forests of New Mexico, the region is a jewel of natural, archaeological, and historical significance. Yet it's under terrible threat from climate change, a threat already in evidence over the recent years of deep drought and raging wildfires. After a brief respite last year, Lake Mead is headed downward again toward historic lows after an unusually dry winter. Bad news for Los Angeles, Las Vegas, and the countless other communities and farms that depend on its water. The Southwest as a whole has been in an 11-year drought, and scientists say that's consistent with the changes brought about by a warming climate. Changes that could spell disaster for the Southwest's burgeoning population and wildlife. My guest, writer William DeBuise, knows the region well. A longtime conservationist, he lives on a farm in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains between Santa Fe and Taos. His books have explored the unique personality of the place, its history, environment, and peoples. Now he's turned his pen to what is and will be happening to the Southwest in his new book, A Great Aridness. William DeBuise, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, it's great to be with you.
You start your book, A Great Aridness, with a story of a murder that happened in 1919, a murder of a trader on the Navajo Reservation. Tell us what happened and why did you start with that story?
Well, I've always found that story to be fascinating because it's a murder mystery that's solved by Navajo trackers, the kind of tracking that a lot of us grew up seeing in B-movies and so forth. But once upon a time, there were people out here in the Southwest who could perform absolutely phenomenal tasks of tracking. And I realized, as I thought about that story, that it's a perfect metaphor for the kind of science that's necessary to solve the riddles of climate change. The trackers had to deal with a trampled landscape with so many footprints and hoofprints in it. And from all that data, to pull out the salient information, to kind of find signal in the noise. And that's exactly what happens in science. Scientists have to look at an awful lot of information, an awful lot of data, and pull out the signal, pull out the narrative, if you will, the story of what's happening in our world, just the same as those trackers had to figure out.
And when you say pull out the signal from the noise, you're talking kind of pull out the long-range climate change from the day-to-day weather phenomenon.
Yes, that's a very good way to put it.
So tell us, what is happening? We've seen mega drought. Well, I guess we can't call it mega drought yet, but we've seen record drought in the Southwest this year. Harbinger of things to come, just noise, signal, what is it?
Well, what we're finding is that the climate change models, the prevailing models, are proving to be very, very accurate, except in one major respect. And that is that the changes that they predict are happening faster than they predicted them to. The primary change is increasing heat. And in the Southwest, that guarantees also greater aridity, because as things get hotter, even if precipitation stays steady, evaporation also increases. You cannot defeat the law of evaporation. And so the future that the Southwest is moving into is a hotter and drier future in a land that is already hot and dry. And the big questions are whether these conditions of increasing heat and dryness are going to trip us over some thresholds in which major ecological changes take place, and perhaps major social changes are also forced.
You live in New Mexico.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about where you live and what it was like to be there this summer.
Well, this past summer, from where I live, I remember a certain day in the summer, I got emails from friends telling me that a gigantic fire had burst out in the Hemez Mountains, directly west of where I live in the mountains of northern New Mexico. I got in my truck, I got my camera, I even got my computer, and drove out to an overlook. And there I could see the plume of a fire burning fiercely near the nuclear city of Los Alamos. And for all the world, it looked like a mushroom cloud. That was the first day of what was soon called the Las Conchas Fire, which proved to be the largest wildfire recorded in New Mexico. And it reburned a lot of the same country that it burned in the Cerro Grande fire in the year 2000. But it was a very different fire. Back in 2000, we thought the Cerro Grande was setting new standards for fierceness. Over 2 weeks, it burned 47,000 acres. The Las Conchas fire, when it broke out, burned almost the same area in just the first day.
Wow.
It was so much more powerful. It was so much more destructive. And that's the pattern that we're seeing in the Southwest. One of the things I like to say in my book is that no big thing happens for just one reason. And indeed, the fierce fires in the Southwest are an artifact partly of how we managed forests over the past century and the enormous fuel buildup that has resulted because of fire suppression. But it's also an artifact of the changing climate. The fire season now is 78 days longer from the first fire in spring to the last fire in fall. 78 days longer on average in the U.S. West than it was back in the 1970s.
You know, this is one of the most beautiful areas of the country. I've been there. I've been in the Hemez Mountains. I've been in the Grand Canyon. I went down the Colorado River for one of the most amazing experiences of my life.
Oh, lucky you.
Yeah.
It is just, it's unparalleled, the wonder of the river in the Grand Canyon.
And I have to say, you know, every time I've been there, I've thought to myself, oh, how I wish I lived here. And it's been followed, and this, we're talking now 20 years ago, when I first went there, and more, over 30 years ago when I first went there. And I remember thinking even then, but I couldn't live here because someday there's not going to be any water left. I want to talk much more about what's in your book, but I still want to tease this out a little bit more. What is it like for you as you face this prospect of terrible drought, dryness, and fires?
Well, I think a drought is going to be the big factor in the decades ahead, and I'm deeply worried about it. I mean, I'll tell you, I've spent my adult life out here in the Southwest, and I feel as though I've been involved in a, long love affair with the land. And one of the things that scares me the most is the prospect that some of the forests that mean a great deal to me, forests that I think of as home, forests that surround the rural community where I live, if they were to burn or to suffer extreme insect infestation and die off, it would be heartbreaking to see certain landscapes change. But that kind of heartbreak is the kind of thing that various populations in the Southwest are already facing. I mean, I write about in my book what the White Mountain Apache went through with the Rodeo Chedisky fire in 2002, which everybody thought was going to be unsurpassed for a long, long time. Well, it was surpassed just last summer with the Wallow fire that burned over 500,000 acres close to the same area. So people who love the land will find their hearts very much exposed as these changes work their wonder.
In A Great Aridness, William Dupuis crosses the border into Mexico to visit the Janos Biosphere Preserve. You talk about Aldo Leopold, who was the great writer and conservationist. He went there in 1936, and he found a biological integrity there that he didn't see on the other side of the border. Why was it intact there? And why was it not intact on the U.S. side of the border?
Well, basically because the activities of settlement, logging, heavy grazing, the building of roads, and just the movement of people hadn't come to that remote part of the Sierra Madre that Leopold visited on an extended hunting trip. And the reason those forces hadn't come there to the Sierra Madre were first and foremost the Apaches, who had successfully resisted the forces of settlement in that area for a couple of centuries. And another factor why the Sierra Madre resisted settlement for so long was the Mexican Revolution, which broke out in 1910, and the ensuing anarchy slowed the process of settlement and the movement of people into the mountains. So when Leopold got there, he found a large ecosystem that had not been disturbed, that was operating according to its time-honored natural processes, including fire, that was keeping it fresh.
And so describe it. Describe the kind of flora and fauna that was kept in balance. I mean, he was so surprised to find a deer population that was neither overabundant nor crashed.
That's right. It's the only occasion in his extensive experience hunting and studying deer that he found a deer population that was in balance with its environment, neither too few nor too many. And there were wolves there, predators, cougar, etc. And they were in balance with the deer. It was an enormously eye-opening experience for Leopold. And it was one of maybe the three most important formative experiences in his development of what he later called the land ethic, which is still something that all of us need to study and meditate on.
The land ethic?
Yes. The age-old problem of trying to live in a land without spoiling it, as he put it, and of respecting the land and its processes and allowing those key processes to operate fully and healthfully.
We're talking with William Dupuis about the coming impact of climate change and the future of the American Southwest. His book is A Great Aridness. You went to Lava Falls in the Grand Canyon. I remember it well. I remember it very well because...
Everybody remembers lava.
It terrified me.
Yeah, you can't not remember it.
I spent the days coming before, as we were approaching Lava Falls, just awake at night, wondering if I was going to survive. Why did you open your chapter about the Colorado River with Lava Falls?
Well, you know, I always want to open a chapter with a measure of drama, and you can't do better in terms of drama and rivers than to talk about Lava Falls Rapid on the Colorado River in the heart of Grand Canyon. And lava actually allowed me to develop a metaphor that I think is really pretty apt about the water situation, the climate change situation in the region. And that is this, that when you're going into a big rapid like lava, all you can do as a boater, all you can control is your point of entry, your angle, and your velocity. You get your run through the rapid set up, and you've got to nail the beginning, or believe me, chaos will take over, and you will be helpless as you go down through the big waves and through the big rocks and so forth. So you've got to get your start right. And that's kind of how we are as a society, looking downstream into the rapids of climate change. We know some of the big waves, some of the big rocks that we have to avoid. And so we've got to get our point of entry right so that we can cope with droughts, so that we can deal with forest fires, so that we can handle the dust and the beetle die-offs and things like that that lie ahead. There may be other things that are going to hurt us, that are going to be dangerous down the way, but that's farther down into the rapids, and right now we just have to be sure we get our entry right and get started right. Because if we don't, we'll just fetch up on the first set of rocks.
Well, we're going to come back to that question. But let's talk more about the river itself. And I want to also tell our listeners that when you talk about beetle die-offs, you're talking about the fact that climate change has brought a huge explosion in pine bark beetles that are just decimating vast tracts of forests in the West.
That's exactly right. In fact, the insects, forest insects, are probably defoliating and deforesting larger areas than the more dramatic forest fires are doing.
So talk about Lake Mead. There's a debate over the future of it. You say in this book a great aridness that it could go dry by 2021. I mean, that's 9 years from now. Lake Mead is a huge supply of the water for the Southwest, for cities like Las Vegas.
Yes, for tens of millions of people downstream. The question of Lake Mead's survival has seen a good deal of examination in the last few years. A team from Scripps Oceanographic Institute looked at it, and their study was then reevaluated by a team at the University of Colorado at Boulder, the Western Water Assessment, which is funded by NOAA, and there was a kind of dialogue back and forth, and the two groups basically came to this conclusion that beginning in about 2026, a little farther out than the date you mentioned, but not very much farther out, 2026 and years after, the risk of failure of Lake Mead, and I'm quoting one of the people involved in the study, quote, just skyrockets. And that's because the water coming, the states below Lake Mead, mainly California and Arizona, are already, they're using more water than they can, than they should. And if that overuse is complicated further by climate change and reduced flows in the river, then the risk of the lake failing goes very, very high. It's not certain, but it's high. And if the lake were to fail, I should explain what failure means. It means that the level drops below all of the outlets of the dam, so that you can't get water downstream. That would be a disaster for Phoenix and Tucson, L.A., San Diego, and cities in Mexico as well.
Right. I mean, the Colorado doesn't even make it to the ocean anymore.
It rarely, rarely makes it to the ocean, which is an environmental tragedy because the delta of the Colorado was once a natural area at the kind of level of the Everglades in Florida.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with writer and conservationist William DeBuys about his latest book, A Great Aridness. It's about climate change and the future of the American Southwest. One of the reasons that there's overuse is, of course, agriculture. When we're talking about agriculture, we're talking about food. You say that agriculture is the biggest use, in fact, of water. And then it's competing with the residential use of water. So what can happen here between these two competing uses? And is there any solution given the kind of scenario you've sketched out here?
Well, certainly in the years ahead, we're going to see more and more transfers of water from agriculture to urban and other municipal uses. That's the lifesaver for the Southwest, is being able to make that conversion and to keep the cities going. The impact on agriculture is going to be very negative, but it's probably one that's unavoidable. The scary thing is, though, that if somehow Lake Mead fails, then all the shifts from agriculture to urban and industrial downstream don't matter as much because there's just not going to be any water to trade around. So as a society, we really need to begin working on these problems. But I have to say that conservation, which many people look to as a solution, is really not a solution because of something called demand hardening. And if I can explain that, if you have 1,000 people who are using water wastefully and drought comes, well, it's easy for them to kind of tighten their belts and get through. But if you have 10,000 people using that same amount of water who have conserved their water using low-flow toilets and xeriscaping their yards and doing all the things that a moral person you would think needs to do, well, in so doing, the water they saved through conservation probably was allocated just to the next strip mall down the road or the next low-density subdivision. And then those people in those places use their water only in essential ways. So now you have the same drought, and you have 10,000 people using what 1,000 used before, but they're only using water for essential purposes. How do you cut back when supply drops? Wow. How do you conserve? Further, you know, when everybody's using only essential water, then when you cut back, you have real suffering. So somehow we have to figure out a way to keep our communities going without giving over our saved water to further growth. And we have to kind of find a solution, a new paradigm to maintaining our communities without relying on continuous growth to keep their economies afloat.
So you're almost talking about a kind of a water budget that needs to limit population.
Yes, I'm afraid so, and nobody's figured that out. The person who does figure how to do that successfully will deserve something like a Nobel Prize. One community, a smallish community, Bolinas, California, limited its growth, limited its water, and said, we're only going to have X number of water meters, and that's all. And in 2009, with them having limited the supply of water meters, demand spiked to such a degree that a water meter in Bolinas changed hands for the tidy sum of $300,000. Imagine that. Of course, you can't do that in a large community. Depriving people of access to water would be deemed a violation of human rights, and indeed it would be. But we just don't have a way to solve this conundrum yet.
Do you think these communities will be abandoned?
You know, I think we are going to see in the Southwest a transformation of quite a few communities. And I think overall, as the century wears on, this will be probably after my lifetime and probably after yours, we're going to see the Southwest shrink quite a lot. I don't think that we're going to be able to sustain the level of occupation we have here now, and I think some communities will suffer quite terribly.
Do you see any indication or any cause for hope? I mean, what are some of the exemplary things that some people are doing to try to if not mitigate, adapt to the situation?
You know, I think we're going to see at the local scale a lot of smallish communities really grapple with these questions. The degree to which our communities can come together and form a consensus that, yes, the problems are big, and yes, we need to take some steps to solve them, that will be a measure of health. That will be an indication of tilting the odds in the favor of successful adaptation. One of the great tragedies is that American society is these days so fractured politically that we can't achieve success, consensus, at least not at large scales. But I think at small community levels, we're going to make some progress. We're going to do better. For myself, I find that I am an intellectual pessimist, but I like to say a neurochemical optimist. The future is grim, but the sunrise is always beautiful. And maybe it's just the serotonin talking, but this land out here, the Southwest, is so gorgeous. There are always going to be people dedicated to making it habitable, to making life in this place work out. But those people who are going to be most successful are the ones who are really willing to adapt to aridity, which is the overriding characteristic of this part of the world.
And it's an important, you can also develop, in doing that, develop models that will help many other parts of the world, which we haven't spoken about. I mean, you speak of the Mediterranean Basin, another one of the most beautiful places around, and many other areas that are going to experience drought. And I think your book is so important, William Dubuis, this book, A Great Aridness, in pointing to the kinds of lessons people need to take all around the world.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And I like to say that in this instance, the revolution will be televised. What happens in the Southwest is going to be sort of a bellwether for what happens in arid regions all around the planet. And nowhere else are these changes going to be more closely watched, more aggressively treated, reported in more detail. So what we experience here in the Southwest is going to produce a lot of lessons for Australia, for the Mediterranean basin, for the Middle East, for other arid regions around the world. And in some instances, the lessons we produce will be lessons that people want to repeat in other places. And in some other instances, almost certainly, there'll be lessons that those other people want to avoid.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
William Dubuis writes about the Southwest from his home in New Mexico. His books include River of Traps, Salt Dreams, and The Walk. His work has appeared in Orion and the New York Times Book Review, among others. His conservation efforts have led to the permanent protection of over 150,000 acres of wild lands in North Carolina and the Southwest. Go to writersvoice.net to find out more about Dubuis's work in conservation. Next up, we talk with Dave Gardner about his film, Growthbusters. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Growth is good, right? Well, what about if it's a growth on your lung or in your brain? Not so good. Runaway biological growth kills, and endless economic growth will do the same thing to our civilization. My guest David Gardner says we're hooked on growth, and we don't need to be. It's coming to an end anyway. In fact, he says, our continued prosperity depends on achieving a steady state or no-growth economy. He sets out to prove his point, with a good deal of humor leavening the facts, in his film Growthbusters, Hooked on Growth. The movie interviews the experts from Paul Ehrlich to Chris Martinson, but it also chronicles Gardner's run for the Colorado Springs City Council on a platform of no growth, a campaign he came close to winning against all expectations. I started out by asking Dave Gardner why he took this issue of being hooked on growth on.
I had spent a few years of my life paying a lot of attention, attending council meetings, and trying to get my community unhooked from its growth addiction and look for some more sustainable 21st century ways of having a healthy, vital economy. And as is made pretty clear early on in the film, I was getting nowhere fast.
What were you up against?
Well, I was up against conservative. My city, Colorado Springs, is a pretty conservative town to begin with, but also not a very young city council, and they were very set in their ways. And they were used to doing things the way we've been doing things as a culture for the last 50 or 60 years. And in fact, one of the reasons I chose to share a little bit of that, my local community growth busting experience in the film, is because it relates fantastically to what's going on at a national and global level. We've decided that the way we were able to operate during the last 50 or 60 years is the final answer, that's the way we're supposed to operate from now on. And of course, if you're paying close attention to the news out there, there's an awful lot of evidence that that we can't keep on growing our way out of problems, that we've bumped up against the limits to growth.
Yeah, the limits to growth, that is the name of a study that was done as much as, 30, 40 years ago that you talk about in the film.
Yeah, it's remarkable what an amazing study it was, and it's a remarkable that we've ignored it almost completely for so long. It's remarkable how it's been dismissed time and again without very much intellectual integrity, and it's also remarkable how closely we have followed the business-as-usual scenario that was created by the computer system in that study.
Well, tell us, maybe give us the highlights of that. What is that scenario that was predicted for almost 40 years ago and that we're following so closely today?
Well, it was a system dynamics kind of approach, and of course that was in the early computing days, so it was highly complex, and it blows me away how they managed to do that. But they fed a lot of assumptions based on the recent track record of resource extraction, resource consumption, population growth, and economic metrics. And they, they did the best they could. They weren't trying to predict the future, but they were trying to see if they couldn't portray at least identify some trends. And I think they were pretty stunned to discover that if we didn't significantly change any of the trends in terms of growing population and growing economies and what have you, that the computer was predicting that we would hit the wall early in the 21st century, that we would have no choice but to have economic contraction and population decline because the planet just wouldn't be able to continue to supply us with resources and the food and the water that we need to stay alive. And, I have always been a conservationist and a great appreciator of the environment, but I have to confess that I haven't been paying attention for all of my adult life. Most of my adult life, I was pursuing the American dream just like most of us, and not paying a lot of attention to the news, the climate change warnings, and certainly the warnings of the Limits to Growth study. So I'm kind of a Johnny-come-lately to that, researching this film. Research began about 6 years ago for me, and it was like unearthing a time capsule. I could not believe how long ago we started to get all of these warnings. And, of course, a lot of the growth boosters out there who think we can grow forever and innovate our way out of resource constraints, they like to say, well, look at that. We've done, you know, we had all these alarm bells ringing when Limits to Growth was published, and when Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb was published, they said we were, you know, going to be facing crises. And look, we've survived, and in fact, we have flourished. So they say that, you know, we've disproved those. But the fact is, in my research, I found that what we've done is we've found some temporary ways to buy ourselves some time. But, you know, just because your bathtub hasn't overflowed while you're letting the water run doesn't mean that it isn't going to overflow if you keep the tap open.
In fact, you have a very telling, I'd like to call it a metaphor. It's not really a metaphor, an example of bacteria growing in a petri dish to illustrate this whole point that, you know, you go along for a long time, it looks like nothing's happening, and then wham.
Yeah, it's a great illustration that's really made famous by a physics professor at the University of Colorado by the name of Al Bartlett, who is retired now, but he's traveled the world delivering this lecture about 2,000 times because it is just so astonishing. It's a great way to teach what exponential growth is all about. And I think why he tells the story is that when someone finds out that the population of their city or their country is growing maybe 1% or 2% annually, that seems like a small amount, and it doesn't raise any alarm bells. Well, but that is, you know, exponential growth. And the first thing Al Bartlett will tell you is if you have 2% annual growth, that means you will double, let's say it's population growth, that means you'll double the population every 35 years. You know, and you double it once, and then you double it again. Well, that's quadruple the population that you began with. And if you plot that on a graph, it creates what is commonly called a hockey stick growth curve. That it looks like, you know, growth can kind of rock along at a pretty low rate for a long time, and then all of a sudden it just takes off. And he illustrates that with bacteria in a jar, where if you have a bacterium and it reproduces itself and doubles every minute, and you start with one bacterium at 11 o'clock and the jar is full at 12, then he asks the class, well, what time was the jar half full? And a lot of people are pretty quick to guess, so 11:30. Well, in fact, the jar is half full at 1 minute till 12. What it illustrates is that you're almost at the end before you even can begin to see that there's a problem. So the fact that Paul Ehrlich or Dennis Meadows and Dana Meadows and the other scientists at MIT who did the Limits to Growth study, the fact that they were warning us back in 1970, you know, and we've been coasting along and things haven't looked all that bad and we've found some ways to solve some problems. But now, if you look at the news, it looks to me like we are, you know, we're at the roller coaster part of that ride now.
Yeah, we're getting close to that 1 minute to 12.
I'm afraid that's the case.
Now, you've just told us about this hockey stick as it applies to bacteria and population, but it also relates to economic growth because a normal, mature industrial economy aims for something like 3% growth, which doesn't seem to be like a whole lot. Connect the dots here between the kind of math you've been talking about and what that kind of a growth rate means.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because I think that is certainly the topic of the year, if not the topic of the decade, with economic growth being such a primary public policy goal these days. And I think it even astonished me when I did the math and determined that, you know, if you have 3%, if you were to be successful at having 3% annual economic growth, that in 720 years, your economy would be a billion times the size it is when you start. Now, none of us are going to be alive in 720 years, but when you think about it, that's not, you know, that's not an unimaginable time frame. You know, that's just a handful of generations from now. And when you think about how, you know, we're acidifying the oceans and we have fisheries collapsing and species extinction at an alarming rate and freshwater crises are already upon us, and the world's major rivers don't even flow all the way to the sea during parts of the year. Now, how can we possibly imagine that we could multiply the size of the scale of human enterprise on the planet by a billion times? How can we even imagine that should be our game plan?
Right. We're talking with Dave Gardner. He's a filmmaker and also ran for city council, which we haven't talked about yet. We will talk about that later in his hometown, Colorado Springs. His latest film was Growth Busters. Now, back to population, that does seem to be the elephant in the room, even for a lot of environmentalists. You know, we don't like to talk about population growth because that calls up such horrors as, you know, the one-child policy in China. Why does population growth seem to be treated as such a good everywhere, and people are crying, you know, like a fire in the room when we read that in some countries population growth is declining? They act as if that's a bad thing.
Well, you know, I think in a way it ties back to this obsession that we have with economic growth, which, by the way, is really a pretty recent phenomenon. We've really, as a culture, only been obsessed with economic growth for about 60 years. The rest of human history, we were pretty content to just try to have our basic needs met. But once we got on this train where we were convinced that we needed economic growth, we started measuring gross national product and then gross domestic product, gross world product. My community, Colorado Springs, actually even has a gross metropolitan product. And in the proposed sustainability plan for this community, one of the goals is to have perpetually increasing gross metropolitan product. Well, once we got hung up on that, on measuring that, we forgot that what really mattered was, you know, just the well-being of an individual. So we just started measuring just the total economic throughput that was taking place. And if you add more people to an economy, well, certainly you have more workers, more consumers, so you have more economic activity. So your measurement, you know, looks good to you because it increased. So we lost sight of the fact that an economy really just exists to meet the needs of the people. So if you have a small number of people, well, a small economy can suit them just fine. If you have a large number of people, they would need a larger economy. And we just lost track of that. We threw logic out the window and just said, wow, we just need the economy to be bigger this year, and adding people to it is one way to do it.
Yeah, and in fact, you say that a city that grows beyond about 200,000, the taxes actually have to go up the more people you add over that number. Explain that to us.
Well, I find it amazing that the facts are out there. That you know, you can look. Los Angeles, for example, has very high taxes, and you look at the smaller communities, and they typically have lower taxes. And across the board, we find this to be true. And yet, the myth that a growing community, you know, that's just the goal of a community. That, you know, surely things have to get better. A growing tax base is good for your community. The myth that there is some kind of a benefit from that is so strong that we just completely ignore it, even though it is proved to us time and time again. And interestingly, Herman Daly, the father of ecological economics, points out to us that the same kind of thing is actually happening on a global scale, and it's called uneconomic growth. You get to a point where the costs of growth actually outweigh the benefits. And at a community level, a community or a city level or a metro level, what happens is, wow, you've got to have you get enough people in this community, you need to have mass transit. And you need to do all kinds of things to mitigate the damage that all those people do in terms of, you've got to have better and better sewage treatment, better and better water treatment. You have to go to greater lengths to provide water, to get source water for the community. You have to mitigate air quality problems and on and on and on. And no one subtracts all of those costs when when the boosters are calculating the economic benefits of increasing number of people and a growing tax base. Same thing's happening really on a global level today.
You also, I mean, one of the things that I found really startling and kind of fascinating is that you make a connection of this to our financial system. You interview Chris Martinson, who lives in the local area of this our home station here in Amherst, Massachusetts. Chris Martinson has the Crash Course, a wildly successful course that's on, he's given on TV, but it's also on the web. Connect the dots for us there.
This is probably the stickiest wicket that we face, and that is that we are stuck with a monetary system that requires perpetual growth. And the way Chris explains it is that that money doesn't just get printed to match gold supply or something like that, but it is actually loaned into existence. That's how money is created in our system today. And once money is loaned, well, it has to be paid back with interest. And how do we get that interest? Because that money hasn't been loaned into existence yet to pay back the interest. So we're caught in this vicious cycle where every year we've got to have more money in the system so that we can pay back our loans and pay back the interest. And a lot of smart people are really working on ways to, or on alternative systems. So we are stuck because we've got to get out of this mode somehow where, all of our commerce is based on loans. And isn't that funny that, what are we trying to do today? We're trying to get banks to loan money. We're trying to grow the economy. We're trying to get people to purchase more products, consume more, all of these things that are really unsustainable, that they all will use up resources at a rate much faster than we are entitled to if we really want to practice the intergenerational golden rule and leave the next generation and the generation after that with a fair chance to live a good life. And yet everything we're doing today is around ramping up the scale of the human enterprise way beyond a sustainable level.
Right, eating into the principle. Well, we may not have to worry too much about the financial system because it seems to be headed for another fall.
Well, and you know what? Let me interrupt. I don't want to be long-winded about it, but the fact is, that's happening because we're at the limits to growth. And I don't think we're going to be able to get back on the horse that brought us here because conditions are different. And so, in a way, I'm not trying to convince people to stop chasing growth. I'm trying to convince them to be comfortable with the end of growth because it's here whether we like it or not, and it'll be a lot more graceful for us to stop fighting it.
You've been criticized, for example, by Mark Gunther, who is a writer on sustainability. He's got a blog, and you responded to him as well. You've been criticized from the point of view of, it's easy for you to talk, for us to talk here in a culture in which we already have so much about an end to growth. But what about all those developing countries, India, Brazil, and China, where people in Africa and elsewhere, where they don't have enough and they need more? So how do you answer them? How can we put the limits, put the brakes on growth and have a sustainable level of development?
Well, I'll be the first to tell you that it's not fair. I mean, those of us in the wealthier developed world got carried away, and we are, as the Global Footprint Network has told us here in the United States, we're consuming resources as though we had five planet Earths. And the only way we're doing that is by not only stealing from future generations, but appropriating resources that really other developing populations are entitled to. So that's not fair. So we certainly owe it to them and to future generations to actually contract our economy, to try to live within our means. But that's a huge challenge, and it doesn't change the bare facts of life, which are that the developing nations, they're not going to get to do what we did. The planet cannot support them going on the same kind of binge that the developed world went on. But the good news is you know what, it hasn't turned out to be, you know, such a Sunday school picnic. It hasn't made us that much happier. It hasn't given us fulfilled lives. We just kind of got off track. So my advice to someone who aspires to have a luxurious North American lifestyle, my advice to them is to not get sidetracked and go down the road to ruin that we went on, because it's going to be tough for us to get into a detox program from growth addiction, and we would have been better off if we hadn't gotten sidetracked.
So you're saying they shouldn't go where we are. It's not making us that happy. But is there a way to create an economy that works for everybody in this world? I mean, I think that's really the issue, because we don't want people in developing countries to be condemned to the kind of poverty and privation that they have now.
No, that's true. There has to be an equitable answer. But the answer is not for them to have a goal of economic growth. I think the answer is for them to have a goal of economic health, of economic sufficiency, because that's where we went wrong. We stopped having a goal of having our needs met and started having a goal of just economic growth. And so we weren't measuring our well-being. We were just measuring, you know, how fast we were trashing the planet. And so I would suggest to them that they, you know, that they change the metric. But it is the biggest challenge our civilization is going to face is how do we rebalance things in a way that's fair? And that's one reason why I think the subject of overpopulation has to be a part of that dialogue, because the more people there are on the planet, the more difficult it's going to be for us to make those economic adjustments and for everyone to have a chance to live a good life. And it's so easy. It's just so easy for us to just voluntarily exercise a little bit of moderation in our reproductive freedom, so that we're not growing and so that we ideally have a slowly declining population, because that will allow us to make the adjustments for economic equity a lot more quickly.
Now, Dave Gardner, in your film Growth Busters, you also show your campaign for office. I was actually surprised at how much of the vote you did get. Tell us about what happened and what did you learn?
Well, that was a fascinating process, and what I did is I decided reluctantly to run for city council because our city was on the rocks. We were crashing just like the national economy was a few years ago, and I knew that the dinosaurs running the town were going to think that growth was the answer, when in fact my belief was that growth had created most of the problems and we really needed a different solution. So I thought it was an emergency, a local emergency. They needed Dave Gardner to come to the rescue and enlighten the town and lead the town in a more sustainable direction. We needed a sustainable prosperity strategy, not based on everlasting growth. I didn't think the town was ready for that, but you know, it was time. We needed it. So I said, I'll take a shot at it, but I'm only going to do this if I can, you know, be honest and really run on a no-growth platform and make that an issue in the election. And, of course, that made it a fascinating election. So one of the smartest things I did was I did try to capture as much of that as I could for the film. But I'm really glad we captured it, because it in a way, it brought out, you know, the conflict, which, you know, in a movie, people like to see conflict. They like to know who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. And I don't know, you'll have to tell me. I hope that I kind of come out as the good guy in the film.
I think you
do. One of the bad guys is my opponent, who was saying, you know, the problem is we're not growing. No growth isn't the solution. And I guess the big surprise was that I got 43% of the vote. I did not win. He won, but he outspent me by more than 2-1. He was incumbent, and I was really pitching an idea that was pretty radical.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. So, I mean, why do you think you got such a high? I mean, it's huge. 43% is huge.
I think it was because I was better looking than him. Just kidding. I think I was probably a better communicator. I offered people, you know, some hope. I think they were a little bit tired of business as usual. But I'll tell you, I think one reason why I'm sure I lost was because my ideas still scared quite a few people. And in fact, I think that the thing that's most interesting about that in the film is the fact that my own election committee, you know, spent so much time arguing with me, trying to get me to not be against growth, because they just wanted to get me elected. You know, they said, get elected, and then, you know, then you can work quietly, stealthily to move the town in a different direction. But I was impatient. I wasn't willing to go to the trouble of running for office if I was going to have to, you know, to sort of lie or moderate my stance to get into office.
So what do you think about that now? I mean, that's a pretty important issue. I mean, it kind of gets to the reform or revolution idea.
Well, I learned a lot. You know what? I learned a lot about what politicians go through. You know, we're so frustrated by politicians not telling us the truth and, you know, delivering us sound bites and then going back on their word. And I found I kind of got to experience that a little bit. And I'd walk into a room and I really wanted the people I was talking to like me. I really wanted the people who were trying to get me elected to be, I felt an obligation to them. I felt an obligation to the people who contributed money to my campaign, you know, and I felt that struggle. You know, I wanted to be really true to my principles, and yet there were these other things pulling at me, saying, well, maybe you owe it to this person or that person to change your stance a little bit. And it was a real battle for me internally.
Now, looking back, do you think it was better, you know, in the sense of you were able to get your ideas out there even though you didn't win? Or do you think if you had to do it over, it would have been better not to be so truthful and to get elected?
Well, you know, I think I've decided that I can be more effective as an outsider. You know, unfortunately, politics requires a lot of diplomacy and compromise, and I think there's not, even though at the national level we might think there is, typically there's not a big shortage of diplomats and compromisers. I think the severe shortage we have is of people who are really willing to stand up for their principles. So I feel like my role as an activist, as a citizen, and as a filmmaker is to define the vanguard. What, you know, I need to define the cutting edge so that if compromise takes place, we're compromising from you know, a much more advanced and enlightened and progressive position, although I'd really rather not see any compromise at all, because I think we're in a global emergency now and we need to become sustainable as quickly as possible.
Well, it's a terrific film. It's hugely enjoyable to watch. I mean, we didn't even talk about your therapy sessions, which I'll leave to the imagination of the listener. It's called Growthbusters, and we've been talking with the producer and director and main actor, and that's Dave Gardner.
Thanks. It's been a treat to talk with you.
Dave Gardner is a documentarian filmmaker and activist in Colorado Springs. Go to writersvoice.net to see the Growthbusters trailer. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.